This is episode number 50 with Nicholas Cox, managing partner at Velocity Ventures. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Sendek, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur. And in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, build better companies, and to give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people. Welcome to a new day and a new episode. I'm excited to sit across Nicholas Cox. A great introduction by Joseph Mokanu. So Joseph, if you're listening, a big shout out to you. Why is it a great introduction? Because if you are a frequent listener of the podcast, I always love stories of entrepreneurs, you know, builders, people that know the blood and sweat and tears that it requires to build something, their journey from being an entrepreneur to becoming an investor. And Nicholas is the beautiful example of that. A few highlights of Nick. I saw you started your career actually with Arthur Andersen in corporate recovery. I was at Deloitte a long time ago, and back then in the Netherlands, actually, I think Arthur Andersen, Deloitte, I think they merged or we acquired them, not quite sure, but I worked with a lot of Arthur Andersen guys back then. But after Arthur Andersen, you did a lot of executive roles, amongst others, Tire Recycle, Resource Co, and Courier. But I think a big part of your journey is, of course, ReadyMix, the company that you founded together with your brother, which actually you exited, I think, partially, but you can tell me much more about it. After that, you kind of like stepped into the VC game. You became CEO of Ready Ventures, which was also an early stage venture fund. And currently you are the managing partner of Velocity Ventures, a venture fund focusing specifically on the travel and hospitality sector. Nick, super pumped that you're here. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, man?
Hey, thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me on and great to be here. Look forward to chatting to you today. I just wish we could do this face to face in Bali.
I know. But that time will come. I mean, the first, I think even like, was it 2 weeks ago or last week, the first flights from Australia came in. So it's it looks there's light at the end of the tunnel. And maybe that's a good segue, Nick. Maybe that's a good segue to kind of like dive into hospitality and travel. How have the last 24 months, how has it been for you, for the fund? Like what's been going on?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty interesting sector to be an early stage investor in. And as you mentioned, Velocity's focus is on early stage companies in the travel and hospitality space in Southeast Asia. And, you know, when we launched the fund, which was just as COVID was starting to be serious in early 2020, you know, we felt that there would be a whole bunch of entrepreneurs out there who needed help, that there would be an incredible disruption and tipping on its head of the industry, that there'd be some valuation adjustments, there'd be some bridge financing needs. And to us, that was kind of fertile ground to set up a fund. So we did that. You know, some people went, wow, this is really needed. Good on you, Nick and Patrick and John and Bennett, who are the guys who I'm doing this with. Other people said, you know, what the hell are you doing? This is an industry that's on its knees. Where are the opportunities going to come from? So we had, you know, a mixed response. But I think the best response that we've had has come from the founders, as always. You know, they're the guys doing the hard yards. And in our first year, we saw 400 companies who came to us from the space.
Yeah.
Incredible ideas, you know, awesome founders, people who had kicked off their business pre-COVID but then been slammed, other guys who, you know, saw a huge opportunity as a result of an incumbent being pushed out of the way. So, yeah, it's been an incredible journey, lots of great opportunities, and super glad we launched it, Andrew.
That's awesome. And what about that? So actually you started the fund actually in the midst of the pandemic. So you were fundraising as well in the midst of the pandemic, which is, I think, is a whole different ballgame.
And I think the challenge from a fundraising perspective and from a founder perspective is trying to get a handle in the early days, at least, on what COVID was going to do. And there was a lot of people, as it was breaking, a lot of people said, "Oh, this is SARS again, and this is going to be over in 3 months, and we're going to work our way through it like we did SARS." But then by March of 2020, it was becoming pretty clear that this was something more than SARS, and the lockdowns kind of reinforced that, and then travel bans came into place, and the full impact of it became real. And I guess it's the seriousness of it that provided the opportunity. I think if it had been a SARS, it would have been a blip like SARS was, and SARS was a serious blip. But the real opportunity for us has come from the fact that this has been such a deep impact on the sector.
It's interesting, right? That in these, as entrepreneurs, as characteristic of entrepreneurs, of course, that they're always opportunistic. And the funny thing is that even that, globally speaking, in that time when you were fundraising, I think the majority of the people would say, I'll put my hand on my wallet and I'm not going to spend anything. My business plan, I'll just put it on freeze. I'll just wait how the world's gonna look like in a few months. But then there will always be people that say this is the time we need to get in. Get in as an entrepreneur, get in as an investor, right? So I salute you for that. I think that's really amazing. Let's go a bit further back, right? Because you were in the cement business, which is kind of like a traditional business, right? It's like a black P&L. It's like it's a proper business. It's a profitable business, right? And I would just love to know, what has been that journey? So after ReadyMix, you kind of started first with Ready Ventures. What has been the journey from ReadyMix to Ready Ventures? And what is the link between Ready Ventures and Velocity? Is there any link at all? Or are these funds separate? Or did you stop one fund? How was that? How did it came about?
Yeah. So my brother and I started ReadyMix in Indonesia in 1990. So they were really early days in Indonesia, just opening up, Suharto era, a lot of development going on. And my dad had been in this industry in Australia. My brother and I were up there knocking around Indonesia, and we saw an opportunity. So we rang Dad, who just retired, and we said, "Hey, we need some of your savings, some of your retirement committee. Kitty needs to come our way. We're going to turn it into rupees and go out and buy some trucks and stuff." So we did that. And John and I were there 90 to 94, building that business up. And then Vietnam opened up. And so we went up to Vietnam, started going there in 93. We opened there late 94. I moved up there in early 95, spent the year of 95 there, opening ReadyMix. So we had the two locations going, and they were incredible years. Southeast Asia construction was booming. ReadyMix Concrete was just the evolution from mixing concrete on site to having it done in a central location and delivered in a mixer truck was happening. Business was booming. We borrowed a lot of money, bought a lot of equipment, hardware, employed people, and had a great time. And it was the fact that we were working in those two locations that brought me to Singapore, which has been home since late 95. And John and I built the business. We went through the Asian financial crisis.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was, that was nightmarish. We had three horrible years where, people didn't pay us, banks wouldn't lend us money. We were on our knees, and we recovered through that and built the business very strongly following 2000. And then eventually exited, and we exited our Indonesia and Vietnam operations, kept Brunei.
Okay.
And it was really that exit that led to the early stage investment phase, which is my second career.
Yeah, that is so amazing. And how do you look at that, right? Because if you talk about the cement business, talk about cement trucks, it's capital expenses are quite big, I think, pretty CapEx heavy business, but it's profitable, right? If you look at it now, within tech, it's high growth, it's fast. sometimes, you know, even investors are asking, okay, where's the IP? Like, where's the real value, right? I mean, I personally had these discussions also with investors when we're looking at our e-com business, like, what's the value? Okay, you got stuck your inventory. Okay, you got the website, you got people. How do you, with what eyes do you now look at these, all these different ventures that you're talking to, that you're investing in? Do you look at it with different eyes because you come from a quote unquote more traditional business? Or is it different? Like, how do you kind of like filter? Mm. How do you filter that?
Yeah. So I think there are some aspects that, you know, are the same. Building teams, creating value, building a moat around your business, financing decisions, these sort of things are, you know, common across tech and traditional businesses. But, you know, obviously there's a lot of differences in the space where we play now, which is, you know, around investing in tech businesses. But ultimately, you know, the common theme across the two has been identifying great people to work with. Mm. And you know, time and time again, the success we had in ReadyMix was, you know, when we had great people on our team, we did really well. Identifying and building terrific teams was fundamental to our success in the early days. And really that's what early stage investing is about as well.
Yeah.
You know, very often we get guys who come through the door at Velocity with an idea and nothing much more. And so, you know, trying to assess them as an individual, what's driving them, what's motivating them, what's making them tick is what we spend a lot of time doing. And that aspect is common across both.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, right? Especially for early stage investors. I have this discussion quite often where we talk about validating entrepreneurs and validating their business models. So there's one side of the story is your financial model, is the projection, it's the Excel sheet, right? But then a big chunk of the early stage investing is actually this entrepreneur, right? So could you share me more on how you look at people? Like, because at the end of the day, you want to optimize your chances of success. And a big chunk of that is dependent of the people that run that business, right? So how do you scan entrepreneurs and come to a point of, okay, this is a go or this is a no-go? What's kind of like your method of operation in that critical stage?
Yeah. Well, one thing to start off saying is it's been incredibly hard to do that over the last 2 years where so much has happened on Zoom. Because as we all know, getting to know people face to face is so much easier. And trying to do a deal without ever having met a founder. And the first deal we did in Velocity was some guys in Hong Kong, and we didn't meet them until like 3 months after we sent them the money.
Wow. wow. Yeah.
So
that's venture capital nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. And it is hard to get to know people and make sure you can work together and understand the character and what's motivating a founder, and do they have the skill set to pull it off when you're trying to do it through Zoom. But I think it takes longer. I mean, people have talked about efficiencies of, you know, working through these mediums, but I think, you know, you need more calls and more interactions when you're doing it through Zoom than if you went out and, you know, grabbed a bite together or, you know, grabbed a beer together or something like that, where, you know, you can, I think it's far more effective to do that.
Yeah.
But I think other things we do is, we do a lot of reference checking and working back through founders' past careers in the same way as you would, you know, if you were employing someone, you know, talking to people they've worked with in the past, and getting those kind of reference checks. But I think ultimately it comes down to, you know, a judge of character and people picking, and that's a whole lot of soft skills. But, you know, that's what we like to focus on at Velocity.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? I think a lot of when you look at VC investing, especially early stage VC investing from the outside, you would say like, okay, it's all financial models, you know, valuations need to click. But I think what a lot of people don't know is that maybe the majority even of especially this early stage where there is, where people, they just come in, they have ideas, right? is that soft part. It's very interpersonal. It's kind of like this trust building that you that the investor and the entrepreneur kind of like need to find, like a common ground of trust where what they say,
that's
you,
right,
you should actually believe, right?
It's super important. And and I think the other thing that helps a lot is founder teams. You know, not everyone has every skill set, and you know, to be an entrepreneur, obviously you need to have a fairly broad range of skills, but you know, it helps enormously if you're doing it with someone else and you've got complementary skills. And so, you know, we have an assessment methodology at Velocity where we put all our companies through three steps and we score at each step along the way. And one of the key things we look at, obviously, is the founder team. And one of those scoring assessments is, are you a team or are you an individual? And just two people alone will get a higher score on our metrics than an individual founder.
Interesting. So that's a good point, actually. So you for sure have the preference above multiple people in the founder's team than only one person building it.
That's correct.
And what's kind of like the reasoning? Because of course you built something together with your brother as well, but what's kind of like the idea behind that?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, having two people in the team, firstly, there's sort of an inbuilt safety there. There's also a risk on relationships between the founders, but it's primarily about, you know, complementary skill sets. And so what we like to see is, say, for example, you know, one founder who comes in who's got a deep tech background, and has perhaps been a CTO in another company, gone through the startup phase with another company as a CTO and can bring that deep tech knowledge. And then he or she might have teamed up with, you know, say a marketing person or someone with deep industry knowledge from that particular sector, like have come out of the hotel or airline or whatever space it might be. And then you put those two people together and then you've got a really awesome lineup of skills. And that's the kind of thing we look for in a founder team is a complementary set of skills like that.
Yeah, I love that.
And backgrounds.
Yeah.
And diversity, I should add, Andrew. You know, I mean, if you've got people, you know, two guys or girls who look the same, you know, that's also something that, you know, we'd look twice at. Whereas if you've got diversity there and you've got, you know, different outlooks, different backgrounds, you know, I think that makes a difference as well.
Yeah, such a good point. Because I think when everyone agrees, then you have a problem, right? So I think that kind of natural tension should be there. So going a bit deeper into Velocity right now. So just going back on Ready Ventures and Velocity, is there a link between the two or are there two separate funds?
Yeah, so Ready Ventures was a fund that my brother and I created using the proceeds from our sale of ReadyMix.
Yeah, yeah.
And we went out and did a whole bunch of early stage investments without any outside money.
Okay.
And that was where we kind of cut our teeth. And you mentioned tire recycling. We did recycling. We did some logistics companies. We did some F&B stuff. And then we did a hotel software solution, a SaaS solution, together with a guy by the name of Patrick Imbardelli. Patrick used to be the CEO of Pan Pacific Hotels here and prior to that was a very senior executive at InterContinental Hotels. And so we did that deal pre-COVID. That was a company called Edom Labs. And then Patrick, John and I had an exit from that. And that it was that investment that we did together that gave rise to Velocity.
Got it.
Came after Ready Ventures. Yeah.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So is Ready Ventures, is there still a follow-on? Like, is there a fund number two or was it more like, you know, we're just getting started and...
Yeah, so there's a portfolio of investments sitting there. We're not doing any new investments in that space in using that entity at the moment because we're fully focused on Velocity.
Yeah.
But there's obviously some ongoing portfolio management and follow-on rounds.
Yeah.
We've had a few exits through that. So yeah. And you know, your typical early stage portfolio, some real winners, some disasters, and everything in between.
Yeah, that's part of the game, right? That's part of the game.
Yeah.
And how do you look at it, right? I mean, building a business, building a cement business, you know, for over 2+ decades and doing the regional game as well within Southeast Asia, it's a long-term thing, right? I mean, you ran the business the mid-90s, you came to Indonesia. How do you look at these hyper-growth businesses nowadays, like within tech, as an investor, right? As an investor, that within 24 months, within 12 months, I just read an article about another like fintech SaaS, like within 6 months, they doubled their valuation to like $5 billion or something. Mm-hmm. How do you look at that? Like, do you look at that with a sense of reservation, or are you like all in, like, let's go, let's jump on this roller coaster? Like, what's kind of like your views on that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot in that one, Andrew. And I think, you know, the first thing is that what we did with ReadyMix is very different than, you know, what tech entrepreneurs are doing with their business. Ours was super old school. You know, we had plant, we had equipment, we had to build. We grew by modern standards very, very slowly. And I think one of the things that's changed a lot since then is access to capital. And, you know, 1990, there was only two places to go to get money as an entrepreneur. You could go to your family and your friends, or you could go to the bank.
Yeah.
And the VC world, you know, didn't exist. Venture debt didn't exist. All the different tiers that you've got just didn't exist. And, you know, so and being a hardware business, we depended on banks a lot. And so we just groveled to banks for 20 years and borrowed in some cases too much from them. And you know, signed personal guarantees and did all that sort of crazy stuff to make it happen. You know, thankfully, the finance side of the business has evolved enormously since the 90s. And you've got, as an entrepreneur, so many different forms of access to capital, you know, right through from, you know, the entrepreneur first type, you know, incubators and accelerators. And I mean, you know, and like most of your listeners will probably know the ecosystem and how it's evolved, but it's incredible now, the support you can get along the way and the different access to capital. So I think that's a really fundamental difference. In terms of, you know, the valuation numbers that you talk about, I mean, we see a lot of people at Velocity, and we saw it at Ready Ventures as well, of people coming to us with, you know, valuation stories, which were built on old model businesses, but trying to apply sort of modern growth tech multiples. And, you know, there's a few train wrecks out there of, you know, WeWork being one of the most sort of well-known ones, of people who tried to, you know, apply these kind of valuations to businesses that just didn't deserve them. And I think there's probably a few more to come, where you've got, you know, fantastic software and tech solutions that are super scalable very, very quickly globally, then I think these valuations probably make sense. But where you've got old school businesses that are just trying to sort of wrap a tech layer around something that's been done before, you know, like a WeWork rent and sublease model, it just doesn't deserve it. So, you know, we look pretty hard at that sort of stuff, and you get used to picking those pretty early in the game.
It's funny enough, right? Because I think valuations, it's like a two-edged sword. I mean, at the one side, I think even from an investor perspective, you kind of like play around with it. You come in with like low valuation, and when that valuation pumps up, it's actually also a good thing for you. So you could exit like with good multiplier, right? But at the same time, the big question is always, what is the fundamental business? And what you said in the beginning, what is the value creation that is happening like within the portfolio company, right? If you now look at portfolios of Velocity, and we talk about the topic of value creation, because I think a lot of VCs out there, maybe all of them, will of course say that, you know, we add more value than just a check, right? How do you apply that for your portfolio companies? Like, how do you add more value than just writing the check?
Yeah. Great question. So I think the first is that we're sector specific. So, you know, being sector specific, you can bring a whole series of skills, knowledge, background to your portfolios that, you know, a more generalist VC wouldn't be able to do because they're investing across a whole range of different sectors. So that's kind of the first point. But drilling down a bit further, what we've tried to do at Velocity is to put together some specific programs that actually put some meat behind that concept. So, for example, we have a corporate partners program. So we've got a number of investors in our fund who are major corporates. And what we do is work on proof of concepts, we work on trials, we work on, you know, introducing not only our portfolio companies, but others that we may not finance, but who are in our ecosystem, and trying to link them up with these corporates and almost working like a CVC.
Exactly.
With our corporate partners. And that's proved really interesting to them. They love to see the insights. So we do a report every quarter for our corporate partners where we take our deal flow and we look through it and we say, well, you know, what's happening in the airline space in terms of innovation? And we put a report together and we share that with our corporate partners like Etihad and so on. And these guys are very interested in that. They want to see what's coming. They want to see what, you know, what's out there that solves their problem. So that's been really useful and very helpful to the founders to get those intros. And, you know, most of the investors in our fund are in some way connected with the industry. So we've got 30 LPs, and I think it's something like 70% have some kind of connection with travel, hospitality, F&B, the sort of sectors that we invest in. So we often go to our LPs and hook them up with our founders and or get a view even before we invest. So that ecosystem is useful. And then we do stuff with like the Singapore Tourism Board. So they have an accelerator here in Singapore where they bring in batches of young companies to, you know, help solve problems in the Singapore ecosystem. So we work with them and we do things like, you know, pitch days and help them to get their investor pitch decks together and teach them, you know, how to talk to VCs. A lot of stuff like that, which is all very industry specific.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a big plus of sector specific VCs versus the agnostic ones. Because, like you said, I think even for entrepreneurs, like when you pitch to VCs, they should actually also think about, okay, what's the added value, right? But I think what you said there, let's say even on the LP side, there's even like sector specific information, experience, ecosystem where these startups can tap into. So I think that's a really great way to like diversify yourself also from other VCs, right? Talking a bit more about Velocity, Nick. So you mentioned earlier, let's say plus minus 30 LPs. Your partners are also very experienced within the industry, right? Could you bring us back a bit to those, you know, pandemic days when, let's say, the three of you guys sat together and you're like, okay, you know, this market is getting hammered, getting punched in the face, but why not now? Let's launch a fund specifically on hospitality and travel. Like, what has been that moment? How did that come about? And how was the first outreach to LPs? You know, okay, some said, okay, we're down with the idea. Others said you're crazy. But bring us back a bit to the starting days of Velocity and what's the current AUM right now?
Yeah, sure. So we when we launched Velocity, which was in early 2020 as COVID was sort of breaking, as I mentioned earlier, we'd had an exit. Patrick, John, and I had an exit from that SaaS product in the hotel space that we'd co-invested. That's what brought us together. We'd had that exit. We were already talking about doing something else together because, you know, Patrick, John, and I had very complementary skills as well. You know, I had an entrepreneurial background, worked across the region. Patrick was a senior executive in Intercontinental. He'd had a very corporate background running massive businesses. And so we had, we were complementary in that regard. He knew the sector incredibly well. I knew the region well. And so that, brought us together, and we did well in that investment with Edom. And we had the proceeds from exit. And I think it was probably after the second bottle of wine, Andrew, that the idea of Velocity was born.
I was waiting for the catalyst. What was the catalyst of this conversation?
We were sitting around after having gone through that process and going, well, what do we do next? We'd had some fun together at Edom. And what's next? Do we split the proceeds and call it a day, or do we say, hey, this is a weird time, but let's plow some money back into the sector. Let's leverage the money we've got by bringing in some more investors and have a go. So that's what we did. And the first people whose door we knocked on to support us were the people we knew. And any first time fund GPs will know, and any founders for that matter will know that it's the people in your network, the people you know, the people you've done business with before, who trust you, who know that you know what you're doing, that will back you. And so that's what we did. We knocked on their door. And we were very fortunate to have a great bunch of guys come in and get us off the ground. So we had our first close and started deploying.
Wow, that's amazing. And if I may ask, the exit that you had before with the hotel software, what was the multiple there? Like just a rough indication of the, let's say, initial investment versus exit.
Well, that was a very quick turnaround because we were in there for less than 2 years.
Wow.
So it was slightly over 2x. On that deal, the guys who we backed did very well. They went off and they're working now with the group that acquired that business, which is a company by the name of Groups 360 that is a consortium of some major hoteliers, and so that was a great exit and a great result for the guys. Earlier than we'd all expected, because the company was only 2 years old.
Wow.
But the founders wanted to take the route of teaming up with someone in the US who was kind of doing some similar stuff rather than going it alone in Asia. So that's where we ended up. And in some ways that was good news for us because it gave birth to Velocity.
Yeah, exactly. Amazing story. And sometimes it's like almost serendipity, right? Where you do deals together, and then out of that partnership, kind of like is Velocity was birthed, right? After that second bottle of wine, of course. But if you go back to those days, so you had some proceeds from the exit, which gave you liquidity to start, let's say, the fund. You did your first friends and family round, first LPs coming in. What was kind of like the first close, and where's the current AUM at the moment?
So first close was at about 40% of our 20 million target. That was last year. And we had some good deals in the pipeline because we've been working concurrently on building our deal flow. So we had some good deals in the pipeline. And so we want to start deploying. So we did our first close. We did five deals on the back end of last year.
Wow.
And deployed fairly quickly through those because we had them kind of banked up and ready to go.
Yeah.
And then heading into this year, we've continued with the fundraising. We're doing well. I think we'll close the fund in June, I would say, of this year, depending on how some of the discussions are going at the moment. And you never get all of these discussions, don't all turn into investments, obviously. But I think if we get the kind of proportion that we're expecting on some of those discussions, we'll probably close the fund over the 20 million target that we're looking for.
Amazing.
And then we've got, some hard work to do to get the money deployed. And being a COVID-themed fund, the window for deployment in some respects is closing. And things are coming back strongly.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a, it's a bit of a tightrope because, you know, the further down the path you get, the more willing investors are to back us in our fund.
Yeah.
But, you know, the less opportunities there are out there to deploy. So, you know, it's a, you're probably seeing that dynamic as I describe it. It's a tricky one to navigate.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we talk about deal flow and then, like you said, it's kind of like a quote-unquote COVID-themed fund. So I see that. I see that time window moving. So I think that's quite interesting to navigate into that. Talking about deal flow, and Nick, you mentioned something where, you know, you did your first close and then, you know, while you're actually still raising to do a final close this year, you're actually already deploying, right? And like you said, it's interesting. You get cash from LPs, but then you feel the pressure, of course, to deploy it immediately. So how do you deal with that deal flow? How do you make sure that you get, like, you know, prime and triple A quality deal flow within your inbox or, you know, on the Zoom? Like, how do you stay top of mind of these travel and hospitality entrepreneurs?
So again, that's one of the things about being sector specific, because what we do every 6 months is we go out and speak to those corporates, speak to our LPs, speak to all the people in the community and try and identify where the trouble spots are and where the problems are in the industry to be solved. So, you know, for example, one of the huge issues in the industry as it's coming back is labor supply. Yeah. You know, a lot of people have left the travel and hospitality and F&B industries. They've in countries like Thailand and Indonesia, they've gone back to their villages.
Yeah.
That skill set's been lost. And as, you know, tourists start coming back, restaurants start opening, people, and this happens in Singapore, Indonesia, it's across the region. There's a huge labor shortage, which is kind of weird, you know, in a place like Indonesia or Thailand to have a labor shortage, but it's a reality. And it's super acute here in Singapore. So, you know, what that's a business problem, right? And so you've got entrepreneurs out there who are solving that. So there's, you know, increased digitization, there's use of robots, there's all sorts of stuff happening in the space to help overcome the labor challenges. So what we do is we do a heat map of the whole industry, identify all those various problems. Labor, and you know that we've got this kind of grid where we put together all of the problems that we see, and then quite often we'll go out and look for companies. So rather than just, you know, have an open door where you know people knock on our door and you filter what comes into the inbox, we actually go, okay, you know, digital nomads, remote working, that kind of travel is a whole new space, which has been created by people working from home and now being able to do it from anywhere. Let's go out and look for companies that are solving that problem and doing interesting stuff in that space. So it's as much outbound as it is inbound, and that's how we drive our deal flow.
I love that. So actually you're also utilizing the expertise of your LPs and the problems that they face to guide you into finding the right entrepreneurs that are fixing that problem.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a problem statement thing. And that's where the corporate partners come in, because, you know, often the problems are faced by these big companies can't be solved by their internal processes. They're looking for startups to come in and work with them and solve them. So that's a source of problem statements. And then you've got areas that are, you know, pretty obvious, like, for example, you know, the need for travel and hospitality to be more sensitive to the environment.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like carbon reduction, carbon offsetting in travel and hospitality is a huge area.
No sound. I don't hear you. Sound is gone. You hear me or not?
Oh,
okay. No, you're back.
Yeah.
You're back.
Yeah, I've got you. Sorry, I lost you there.
No worries. Now that's amazing, and especially the one like offsetting carbon footprint. I think that's definitely a very interesting trend that I think we'll be hearing more of in the coming years ahead. Nick, two final questions. You've been an entrepreneur. You know what it is to build businesses. You are an investor. You know what it is to invest and exit, and you know, to add value in that specific industry. What do you think would be the difference between a good investor and an amazing investor?
Andrew, I've lost your volume again.
No, you hear me now?
Are you there?
Yeah, you hear me now? You hear me? Hello. You hear me? Hello. Are you back? Are you back, Nick? Hello. I do hear you, kind of. You still there? Nick, you hear me? Yeah, you're back.
Okay. Have I got you?
Yeah, I got you. Yeah. We're back. Yeah, this happens.
Sorry about that.
No. This happens. I just flicked the different the Wi-Fi. But Nick, yeah. I want to ask you two final questions.
Yeah.
So number one is what do you think would be the difference between a good investor and an amazing investor?
So I think, you know, great investors manage to have terrific insight into the future, but they also are quite disciplined about making diversified bets. Found moving from an entrepreneur to an investor is to build diversity into the portfolio. And although we're focused on a specific sector, we're trying to get our investments deployed across F&B, across accommodation, across experiences, across travel services, across transportation, to have some high-end deep tech stuff, some less tech stuff. All it's a technology fund. But if you then take a step back, what we would hope is that our LPs would have a slice of capital allocated to venture capital, a slice of capital allocated to PE public markets, classic portfolio construction stuff. And I think, as you move from building a business as an operator, where you think you can kind of solve all the problems in your business, which you obviously have to do, to more of an investment mode, you realize that you can't solve all those problems in all of those businesses. You have to step back from that.
Yeah.
And that's the founder's job. But what you do to mitigate that is to have a broad spread of exposures across a whole range of different businesses. And that's the classic VC model. And I think a lot of angel investors probably underestimate that a bit as they move from, founder to angel to VC, as I did, is that, portfolio diversification and construction is a key part of what you have to do to make money in this space. And there's a lot of thought and careful consideration that goes into that.
Yeah, I love that. From founder to angel to VC, I think that's a beautiful that's a beautiful journey. And I think I said it to you before. I mean, it's definitely something that I admire. So that is amazing.
Thank you.
Nick, final question. Imagine a day far, far away into the future, right? And on this specific day, I tried to look up Nicholas Cox. I tried to look up your achievements of ReadyMix and all the different things that you've done. But your digital footprint is totally vanished. There's nothing to be found about you or any accolades that the market or that the world has given you. The only thing that I can find about you are three bullet points. And these three bullet points are the life lessons that Nicholas Cox wants to leave the world with. What would those life lessons be?
I think firstly is to be respectful of your relationships, and you know, whether they're personal, whether they're business, they're everything. And you know, the relationships that I've formed during my business career have been so fundamental to, you know, all the successes and the failings and challenges I've had have been where relationships haven't held out. And I think that's super, super important. So that's number one. Spending time with family and making sure that there's a balance in your life would be number two. And I think number three would be to keep reinventing. You know, and you know, I had an awesome time building ReadyMix. I had a lot of fun. I learned a lot starting Ready Ventures. I'm having a blast at Velocity as well. And, you know, there'll be a next phase where I move on into, you know, probably a more non-executive role at Velocity, hopefully still involved in, you know, some helping entrepreneurs and choosing deals. But you got to keep evolving. And I think that's probably, that'd be my point number three and probably my most important point, Andrew.
I love that. I love that. Reinventing ourselves. And I think, you know, for someone in tech, as an investor or as an entrepreneur, I think reinventing yourself or the business that you're active in, I think is a constant reminder of, you know, that we need to keep doing that to evolve. So I love that, Nick. I love that. I want to thank you so much for your time, for sharing your journey. It's amazing. And I want to salute you for launching a fund in the pandemic. I mean, there's a lot of naysayers. I can imagine that you've come across in that specific time of the world, but you've managed to pull that off. All right. And be active in this very specific industry, which has been turbulent to say the least over the last 24 months. So that is amazing. I really look forward. I'm excited to see where Velocity is going to invest in the coming years ahead and how the fund will evolve as well. I look forward to staying in touch with you, of course, and hope to see you soon in Bali, Nick. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been great to be on the show and wishing you all the best as well.
Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please make sure to subscribe over on Apple or Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review and let me know what your biggest takeaway is this episode. Thanks again, and I hope to see you in the next one.